My talk today, tonight, is going to be about what you could call failures of journalism, I guess. What journalism is not doing, and what some people are doing about it.
I could probably open the other window. No, this one. No.
Did you hit F7?
Yeah, I think I did, but. Okay, here we go. So my name is Lockman. My talk tonight is titled Global Voices, One World. The title is a throwback, really, to an old UNESCO report from 1980. The UNESCO report was titled Many Voices, One World. It was chaired by Sean McBride. And UNESCO basically commissioned a report in the 1980 in the light of satellite technology, computer technology, to assess the state of the global communication system back then. It was a controversial report. Its recommendations basically led to the direct withdrawal of the United States and the United Kingdom from the UNESCO. And they only rejoined recently, actually. UK in 2003, I remember, and the US like a decade ago, maybe. One of the major concerns that came out of that report was the dominance of industrialized nation states, the West, both in the production and the distribution of communication, of news, how the world, how the news in the world was basically a one-way flow of news from the West to the rest. And it made many sort of radical recommendations in order to remedy that. So I'm interested in the sort of, so, in 1977, George Gerbner, who was the former dean of the Annenberg School, he had an article called The Many Worlds of the World's Press. And what he did was he looked at many different kinds of newspapers around the world, looked at the front pages, did a content analysis, and was looking at how often countries are mentioned in foreign news. And so he actually had many different kinds of, like, the world according to U.S. newspapers, is this picture, right? And you see that Africa is a tiny, tiny part. And he drew several of these maps. And it points out the importance of the following question, basically, which is, how does news shape the way we see the world, right? Like, how much do we get news from Africa, from China, and in what way do we get those news, and what kind of frame is the news about Africa told to us, right? If you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, there was a whole set of this classic newsroom ethnographies. What people basically did was researchers would go to CBS, for example, and sit there for like years trying to understand how journalists work and how the work that they do, in the way that they do it, would shape the news. And a very important finding out of those studies was that the kind of work routines that journalists have, trying to meet deadlines, trying to categorize news into hard and soft news, determines a lot of what becomes news and what doesn't become news. Similarly, a cultural studies scholar, Stuart Hall from Britain, in Britain, he had a classic study called "Policing the Crisis," who looked at the sort of dominant journalistic value of objectivity and how that shaped the news. And in a study that he did, looking at the phenomenon of mugging in Britain back then, he found that the journalists, in their search for objectivity, would primarily turn to so-called institutional players, people who had credibility. Think of officials, but also think of, you know, the police. And so ironically, you could say, the journalists who, in their search for objectivity, end up reifying these primary definers, these like police, and they get to define the event in a way that the people, the deviant minorities, would not be able to, because the journalists would not seek them out as much. In these few decades, of course, many things have happened, and one of the most obvious things, obviously, is that the internet has arrived, right? And so one of my questions is, for my study is, how has the internet changed the way we produce news? And also, how indirectly does the internet then shape the way we see the world? Something that the internet has done a lot of good, right? It has democratized the ability of people to speak. The blogosphere is one obvious example. And it has given this proliferation of voices. This is a picture of a overwhelmed cat. What we often miss, and what I call the challenge of the internet, is despite the proliferation of voices, there's also still the same amount of attention that we have ever since the internet came. There might be like, you know, a million news sources out there, but our capacity to read them has essentially not changed that much. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this website. It's the anti-CNN website. It has been a huge movement in China a while ago. It was in the light of Tibet and the Olympics. And there was a particular photo that CNN had published that people were pissed about, where they were cropping out, you know, one part of the picture so that, you know, it looked like totally looked really bad, but anyway. The point is, even now, even as of this year, people are concerned with how the net shaped the way Americans, in this case, view the world, right? How the CNN shapes the way they see China. And people in China are concerned about that. The difference now, these days, is that actually people are able to come up with the counter-narratives a little bit more easy than in the past. The difference, for example, is that they probably, the Chinese people in the past, had no access to CNN material in the first place, so they could not even see that they were being portrayed in a certain way. They had no distribution channel, the internet, that allowed them to make this website and publish a counter-narrative. And it was also not that easy to coordinate and collaborate to get people together to make this website. What this website also shows us is a challenge of globalization. What do I mean with that? John Thomason, who wrote a book on globalization and culture, has the following quote. I won't read it, but you can. I won't read it aloud, but you can read it yourself. I'll give you a few seconds. So, his question is basically, the fact that globalization has brought us together physically has overcome physical distance. The fact that All this information out there, all these people out there that we can so easily reach now, whether, you know, and the internet is obviously only one component of them. Airline travels made it much easier to visit foreign countries, etc. We can only assess the success of globalization if that kind of physical distance that has been shortened also has a corresponding cultural distance shortening. So, like, you know, the fact that we can actually speak to each other doesn't mean anything if we are not really speaking to each other but just shouting at each other. So this is the sort of question that I'm obsessed with, I guess. And I propose to look at news as a site of how do we resolve that kind of cultural distance? How do we overcome that? How does the news portray other cultures, other people? And the traditional way to look at it is foreign news, right? The fact that foreign news seemingly is in decline these days is kind of an irony. If you, with globalization increasing, with more and more access to other parts of the world, the story that we get, at least from you know, Columbia Journalism Review and all the pundits out there, is that foreign news is news in general, newspapers in general are in decline, but particularly foreign news, foreign bureaus being closing everywhere. I think they're missing the picture. There's a lot of what they've been looking at so far is what we call like market foreign news is like a market failure, right? It's like a lot of the reasons that foreign news is failing is because the market is not doing its job anymore, or at least that's the traditional story. That's the traditional argument. What we haven't been looking at is how civil society is picking up the slack of where the market is failing, where nonprofits kinds of organizations are picking up the slack. And this is sort of a similar argument to how Yochai Benkler, for example, would say how things that were originally done by the market are now shifting increasingly to something called peer production. So what I propose to look at in specific is a Bergman project that has been here for a long time. It was founded by two Bergman fellows, Ethan Zuckerman and Rebecca McKinnon. It's called Global Voices. I don't know how many of you actually know Global Voices. Can I see hands if you do know? Okay, for those who don't know Global Voices, it was founded in 2004, so it's been around for a few years now. It's now, as of January this year, a nonprofit organization in Holland, legally in Holland, but it's virtually anywhere basically, because it has an editorial team of about 33 people and a large number of volunteers, and they're all around the world. And essentially, what they do is they do this. They realize that the internet is a big space out there, and a lot of people talking in different parts of the world. But they're not necessarily talking to each other. So you have, you know, the Western blogosphere that is talking a lot to each other, but, you know, not necessarily to the Chinese blogosphere. And the Chinese blogosphere is talking a lot about, you know, so the two are not communicating, and you have all these different blogospheres around the world that are not all these people talking, but not to each other. So what they do is they have like a large team of volunteers out there that are very familiar with particular regions of the world, right? So you have the person who is always looking at the Chinese blogosphere, who keeps track of it the way we do, you know, here in the Western blogosphere. What they do is they pick up the really interesting conversations that are going on at that moment in time. And then translate what is going on and what is the hot issue happening then, and contextualize it though that, you know, like over here we understand it, right? It's getting incredible momentum in the fact that, you know, at first it was, okay, let's translate what's happening in China and make it understandable for people here in the West. And so we, you know, we translate from Chinese to English. now they also have like a translation team where, you know, they pick the English text and translate it like, you know, like 13 different other languages so that, you know, you can pick an arbitrary combination, like, you know, Arabian or Saudi Arabian bloggers know what's going on in, you know, Venezuela. It is particularly interesting in times of international crises, like, you know, like the anti-CNN incident back then, you know, what are the people in China saying about this, you know, like, you know, what are the people in China saying about the Olympics, right? Like, you know, we thought, you know, like China, what are the people in China thinking about, you know, what China is doing in Tibet? It might be a different picture than that we're getting here from the through the mainstream media. I get this question a lot by my professors who are supposed to push back on me. And the question is, like, who reads these blogs anyway, right? Like, why does it matter? And in the case of Global Voices, I am able to answer, look, you know, like, it does matter that, you know, who reads these blogs, because Reuters, for example, reads Global Voices. They actually source material from Global Voices. For example, they have Africa.reuters.com has a country page for each African country, and on each page there's an RSS feed from Global Voices going into that page. Another really interesting project that they've been doing is Voices Without Votes, which is a project that is looking at what people around the world are saying about the American election here. So earlier I posed to you the challenge of the internet, which was, you know, there's a proliferation of voices, but we don't have always that much attention, right? Like, or at least not as much as, you know, the number of voices has increased, but not our attention equally. There's also the challenge of globalization. We have overcome physical distance, but we have yet to overcome the same kind of amount of cultural distance. Interestingly, if you look at the motto that Global Voices has, and it's on there, it's called, "The world is talking, but are we really listening?" So in many ways, it captures the kind of the question that John Tomlinson was asking us, right? Like, you know, like, all these people are talking, you know, like, the physical distance is no longer there, you know, like, it's, that constraint is gone, but are we really listening? The question that Global Voices is posing to us, "The world is talking, are you listening?" is essentially, I would argue, a question of hospitality. This is my rough working definition of hospitality that I borrow from Roger Silverstone, who was a professor at LSE, and he passed away last year. He wrote a book called Media Morality, thinking about what kind of thinking about the relationship between the media and morality, right? And so he's been arguing that we've been doing a pretty bad job so far, arguing that for this notion of hospitality, which he defines as the ethical obligation to listen to the other, which, you know, is in essence what Global Voices is trying to address, right? There. So hospitality has I'm interested in hospitality as a sort of condition of the media, how we can think of how we can think of hospitality as a journalistic value, as opposed to, let's say, objectivity. Hospitality has a really rich tradition that goes all the way back to Immanuel Kant, and in his work on perpetual peace. Derrida wrote about it, Silverstone basically imports it to media studies. So a lot of the work that has been, there's been not that much work done on this motion, but the sum of the work that has been done has been focusing on television, has been focusing on the kind of humanitarian news. I'm interested in thinking about hospitality in the context of the internet and citizen journalism. I took Joris, thank you Joris for organizing this, by the way. I took his statement saying that this was a work in progress very seriously. So I would like to end with what I think are four stakes of hospitality, four things that are important that make it relevant for why we should think about this. My four stakes are the two C's and two P's. My marketing professor would be proud of me. The first C is commons. It's the idea that increasingly we share a common space. And that space is primarily in the media, because the media is both the context and it contextualizes the world for us increasingly more and more, and especially the internet. The picture is, of course, hopelessly naive. It doesn't look like this.
Alas.
I would hope we would work towards that, but so what it misses, obviously, is that the world is increasingly getting crowded, and with a few who are disproportionately powerful, right? And there are issues of misrepresentation and underrepresentation, both in the news, that this picture is not showing. But what I would like to point out is that hospitality will be a valuable framework in understanding these kinds of relationships that we increasingly have to face. The kind of physical distance the fact that there is an increasing interdependence means that we need to figure out how we get along with each other. And hospitality would be a useful way to think about that. What this picture also doesn't show is the fact that the space that we are sharing, the media that we are sharing, is increasingly a space that we are sharing with the voices of strangers. Right, and that's the sort of question that Tomlinson was asking us when about cultural distance. Right, which brings me to my next C, which is control. Can you guys see the great firewall, great wall in the back? So, the fact that we are increasingly sharing a space with strangers leads us to care a lot about control. And oftentimes, the practice of censorship is justified on the basis for a need of stability of control, right? And there's a long-standing debate going on about openness versus closeness in media systems, but particularly on the internet, with recent debates about network neutrality, for example. Implicit in the dichotomy that we have about between open and closed is control. Implicit is that if you're open, there is no control, and if you're closed, you are in control. What I hope to break with hospitality as a framework is to break this dichotomy, is that it is showing that to be in control doesn't mean that you have to be closed. And I'll explain in the next frame why. At the basis of hospitality, is a difference, an asymmetry in power. The obligation to listen to the other, right? And it's an ethical obligation is a result of exactly because some people have a much more powerful voice than others. Some people have much more power in media than others. If you think about hospitality and inviting friends over, the obligation to be hospitable to the other is because you are at home, it's your space, and you're inviting someone else over. And so there is this asymmetry of power, right, where in order to be more equal, you who are the host, temporarily suspends your power and actually create a situation where you're actually serving the guest, right? If you translate that to media, or if you translate that to the internet, for example, which despite the fact that, you know, like it's very easy for you to speak, it doesn't always mean that you are listened to. And especially on the internet, NYU professor Clay Shirky has written about the power law in the blogosphere, meaning that there are millions and millions of blogs out there, but only like, you know, 10, 15, 20, I don't know the exact number, but a very small percentage gets, you know, 80% of everybody else's attention. Everybody reads, you know, Daily Kos, Huffington Post, and not my blog.
But why?
I'm not saying we should, by the way, but the interesting thing about power so far and the media in the literature so far is that the relation that people write about this is usually that it's a bad thing. It's not a good thing that, you know, we have this concentrated power in media. You know, like the literature on media ownership concentration usually is saying, oh, you know, this is very bad. And I'm not disagreeing with them. But the solution that they offer is usually the radical solution of, you know, everybody, this should be like a wide dispersal of media power, right? The only sort of positive effect to power in media so far that that people have written about is something a professor of mine has written about, Elu Katz, who wrote about and he's referring back to, you know, when there was only one public channel or two public, you know, public television channels. We had such a nice time then because, like, everybody was watching the same channel, and, you know, like, we had a common culture because of that and a kind of coherence, and we all knew what we were talking about. The standard criticism against that argument is like, look, that's really paternalistic, right? Like, you know, telling people what they should watch, you know, like, why can we not decide for ourselves what to watch? If you insert hospitality in that metaphor, so no, you can change the metaphor from father to son to host and guest, which I think is more fruitful in thinking about relationship in media. One question I often also get is like, you know, why should the people who are in power, who have the power, you know, why should the New York Times be hospitable at all, right? Why should they care? You know, they don't have to. That's really a rational choice theory driven argument. It's like they have no interest or incentive to do so. And if you turn it around and you actually see acts of hospitality, you know, people are hospitable to guests, right? And increasingly in the media, phenomena like Global Voices are being hospitable. The argument to why should people care is really that, you know, like, rational choice fails to explain why, you know, people actually do care. Wait, why is it not jumping? While my computer is working very hard to jump to the next slide, come on. The final P, I have two C's, one P, this is my last P, is perspective. There's a book by Kristen Munroe who, then the book is called The Heart of Altruism. Oh, there we go. She suggests that that altruism, altruistic acts, are not best explained by rational choice, obviously. Like, you know, like, this is hard to explain why people are altruistic. You know, rational choice theory has some, like, you know, lame attempts to fit it into the theory. But the suggestion she makes, Kristen Munroe, is perspective is something that drives us, that motivates us to do certain acts. We need to think about how news builds perspectives, how the news shapes the way we see the rest of the world, but also ourselves, and our relationship from ourselves to others. It might help us explain or answer this question, right? This question came, a lot of people in the US asked them themselves after 9/11. But it's increasingly also a question that, you know, China has been asking itself in the light of Tibetan Olympics. So it's, you know, and it's not just an US phenomenon. This is a Necker cube. It shows that you can look at something from at least different from at least two perspectives. So the value of something like Global Voices, of citizen journalism in general, I think, is not to think about it as much whether it's about increasing or decreasing the level of truth, but it's really about increasing the range of the kinds of truths that we can listen and get exposed to. So and so far, the news production process, journalism has so been dominated by this idea of objectivity. What I really suggest is that we might want to think about hospitality as a value to introduce into journalistic work. And that is also not a new idea. Herbert Gans, a Columbia professor who passed away last year, introduced this idea that instead of objectivity, we should try to aim for something he called multi-perspectival news. Obviously, he never ran it through a marketing person. But the idea that news should be able to carry more than one perspective, multiple perspectives, and objectivity, ironically, started out as something that was an attempt to do so, like to try to be fair and balanced, present two sides. But maybe we need to reassess that. I started off my presentation with this map, right, of the world and how the news gave us this image of the world. This is how it looks like, like as of last year. This is a map that PRA, Public Radio International, Alyssa Miller presented at TEDCon, and it is based on the kind of on the number of minutes is allocated to different foreign countries in broadcast television. So it's a little bit different from the Gerbner study because it looked at newspapers. This looks at broadcast television, but it gives you the basic idea, right, that in those 30 years, we don't have to seem improve much and probably have gotten worse, if you look at the map at least. So while technological advances and journalistic innovations are addressing the challenges of living in a globalized world, there still remains a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot at stake. What my paper has been trying to do is focus on a project that plays a critical role in this debate, I think, explore what they do, and try to make sense of it. Thank you. Questions?
So I want to pick a qualm with you with your statement that a few are getting more powerful. I would assume that at the time of Chinggis Khan and Julius Caesar and Hitler and Mao Zedong and Stalin, and there was a lot more power concentrated in a lot fewer hands.
I'm sorry, I don't.
You know how you said that there is a lot of fewer people that the power is concentrated.
Yeah.
So I suspect, especially with internet, there is a lot more people who have a piece.
Yeah. Well. So, first of all, let me clarify that I don't want to be apologetic about media corporations right now who are have a lot of power. And are not doing always, producing the best kind of news that they do. Second, about the internet, it is true that the internet has given a lot more people voice. So I recognize that, I acknowledge that. What I'm trying to convey is that the fact that people have a voice doesn't always necessarily mean that people are being listened to. So the internet has contributed in that regard, allowing people voice. But a lot of the research shows that despite the fact that there are so many people speaking out there, we we still have a routine of just turning to, you know, the three or five websites that we daily, that we every day turn to. I mean, when was the last time you actually found a new blog, you know, that, you know, you, or you actually go on purpose to find a new blog that you find interesting, right?
It's probably the wrong group to ask.
Okay.
I want to ask a question myself. So, if you talk about hospitality, how would you say that relates to a value of acknowledging the other person? And to me, it seems like, for me, journalism, I look at it a lot from the perspective of freedom of expression, and sometimes then also said that it's that news is allowed to provoke, news is like journalists are allowed to go a little bit further than what would seem to be hospitable. But if I translate it to acknowledgement, then like then it works for me again, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm really addressing this other like a party I totally disagree, but I acknowledge him as a real person. So how do you see that that kind of tension with hospitality sounding very like kind of like a sweet thing, or should I be too nice?
What do you mean when you says it sounds sweet? It's big.
Hospitable sounds to me. It sounds like someone is inviting you to dinner. You know, it sounds like.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Well, I mean, so how do you distinguish and still keep the quality of news high and sort of rigorous and involved and engaged? Let me play, you know, devil's advocate.
Sure.
Wouldn't is sort of equally distributing all news distribution production and making everybody equally hospitable sort of mean an ultimate mush of news in which everyone sort of tells each other what a nice day they're having in their immediate language, and that's translated into other languages?
Yeah,
I obviously don't agree with that, but to illustrate the weakness.
Well, so first of all. These are really good questions, and I've been trying exactly to think about how this would be a practical implementation, how that would look like, whether it is in software code or in legal code or in like social norms, and in social norms we know how to be hospitable, right? You know, like we provide food, we drinks, we introduce ourselves. In software code, for example, that's the battle right now. It's about how do we keep the internet open, right? It's in essence, you could say, network neutrality. You could be understood as almost like an unconditional hospitality, in the sense that, you know, it doesn't even care who comes in. You know, you're all welcome, which has problems because, you know. For example, Indie Media, another alternative media organization, had huge problems with this problem I call unconditional hospitality. It allowed everybody who wanted to speak through their website. You know, every lunatic could, you know, post on their website. You know, and a lot of people who post on their website didn't necessarily share the same ideology that they had. You know, like right-wing racist people, you know, posting on their. And they were like, you know, what are we going to do? In legal code, there's actually been a long tradition in thinking about these issues, especially in the United States. Things like the equal time rule, the fairness doctrine, which, you know, is a red button here, so I don't feel comfortable bringing that up right away, but the lessons that we can draw from those experiments would be useful in helping me think about how hospitality would be implemented. And I think what you earlier mentioned about, you know, like how do we maintain a certain level of quality, right? If everybody, you know, like gets to be in. I think we need to draw the distinction between what I earlier said about the wide dispersal of media power as the solution to media concentration power, where, you know, everybody effectively, you know, like has, you know, the same loudness and voice, you know, everybody gets to speak. So like, how the hell do we distinguish who is important and who's not? That is not what I'm proposing. Like, you know, there are people in power, you know, like, and for the time being, that I don't think that's going to change, you know, precisely because of our, you know, attention span, like the limited time that we have in a day. What we need to be clear about is the kind of rules that those people in power have in admitting. What are the rules, you know, that they use to allow people to get in? When do they get kicked out? You know, so what are the breaches of hospitality, and how do they get reconciled? Those are the kind of questions that we need to think about a little bit more, you know, because like right now it's like, you know, like who gets into the New York Times? Like, I don't know, you know, like how do you like?
This is some of the same stuff that I'm interested in. So hospitality is an interesting notion, one I hadn't really thought about. The term I've always used to describe it is one of empathy, which is just encouraging people to have multiple perspectives. And I don't know if that will be helpful for you, but it's just something to think about. It might feel away from some of what you're talking about, because hospitality to me doesn't indicate a change in power dynamics.
Yeah, right. That's a good point.
The second note is, I'm curious what your definition is of citizen journalism. I'm a huge fan of Global Voices.
Yeah.
But I would not, I would not call the individuals, characterize the individuals who contribute to Global Voices as necessarily a citizen journalist. They're very often professional journalists or professional bloggers that are representative. Are put forward as elites in their country that are for consumption in another location. So in one sense, although you can talk about that in terms of a global commons, I would just caution you to sort of be thoughtful about what that's suggesting, because in a lot of cases, people who are participating in Global Voices are not representative of the country. But my question is actually just whether you thought that, because I look at these issues as well, is whether when you think about these notions of global commons, whether part of what you're sort of putting forward is this notion of a global citizenship and these sort of global notions that actually, again, have a lot to do with power relations and have a lot to do with the sort of scaling away from questions of the nation state and of nationalism, which in a very real sense do present a direct, directly challenge countries and countries like China. So when you're sort of thinking about issues around openness, it's just something to be thoughtful about, because I think that that's not, maybe because you're early in the process, so I didn't see a lot of that. Historically, it sort of depends on how you think of the internet. You think of the internet as an extension of broadcasts. There's a long history of thinking about broadcasts as, you know, that nations really have clear control within their borders about how they handle that information. So the internet, in some cases, in some countries, presents just a direct challenge to sort of conceptions about the nation. And that's something that maybe you see a little bit as well. So, but I don't know the answers either, because it's some problem.
It's difficult problems.
Yeah, and it's like, and partly it's because there's a multiplicity of things happening, and it probably isn't one simple. I mean, for me, the problem with global commons is whose commons is it? And the fact even that Global Voices is, I don't know who reads. My sense is that it all. You know, I know it's published in a number of languages, but I don't know who the readership is. So very much the internet is not this apolitical thing. The internet is very much has politics.
Sure.
And so global commons a little bit becomes a different term. So I don't know the answer. I'm imagining that people have very different opinions about that.
So those are really good comments. A few quick thoughts back. So I agree with you that Global Voice is definitely not representative of citizen journalism at large. I would argue that it's a subset within citizen journalism. And so instead of thinking about citizen journalism as like one thing, you know, that, you know, there are different kinds of things in it. And so Ethan has talked about this notion of bridge blog, that it's trying to, what Global Voice is trying to do is that it's trying to bridge different cultures, people across different languages, cultures, boundaries, right? Another way to think about bridge blog is really that, especially in the context of Global Voice, is that it's a bridge between citizen journalism and the citizen journalist and mainstream media. So like a subset within that. So you could, you want?
Which is why it might be something, I think citizen journalism has been used to that, to really, I just wonder what its value is.
I mean,
I don't know where Ethan stands on it, but I would even push you to like come up with something. There's maybe a slightly different, I don't know if there's another term for it, because they're not professional, but they're...
Well, I mean, there's just, yeah, I mean, there must be a reason why you didn't use it, so.
But there was public but the civic media and, you know.
But I mean,
people who Ethan tends to use citizen media more than citizen journalism.
For me personally, it's a crutch. It's become, I don't think there is a better term out there yet, and I haven't invented it myself. And it is the most well-known term out there right now, that most people will know. It's, the ambiguity of it is also sort of helpful for me, precisely because, you know, like, so that it's not fixed, you know. And I understand it personally as the rough definition that I use for citizen journalism is a sort of journalistic innovation that is trying to be more inclusive, that is reliant on the internet as a technology. Because the fact that, you know, it's trying to be more inclusive isn't new, right? We had public journalism in the past. So what I would say is, like, in a very simple equation almost, it's like citizen journalism is public journalism with the internet, where, you know, the journalist have no choice but to, you know, give some control up, you know, because the whole critique against public journalism was, you know, it's fine that you try to be inclusive, but you still are trying to, you know, control the whole thing, right? I mean, you still want to be moderator of the debate, you know, you still want to have final say over, and that is changing because of the internet, right?
But don't you think that so much of the stuff that's called citizen journalism is nothing at all like public journalism? I mean, in fact, a lot of it isn't journalism. Does it intend to be? I mean, it's more this participatory, because of the way it shades into the whole participatory culture.
I like annotation. I have a friend who's been working on, you know, we could call it citizen annotation. At least one of the, you know, sub items.
I mean, we've been using participatory media partly because we don't like using, there was a sort of political correctness issue about citizen media.
Yeah.
I think that ultimately and more generally what we're talking about is a form of civic duty or participatory collaboration. And this is just one facet. This is the reporting of the issue. So, I mean, just defining it as one thing may not necessarily work as part of participatory culture that is taking and then running with it and then self-reporting. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot more ingrained. Defining it the same way you define journalism, as there are journalists that do journalism in a journalistic way.
That's the same problem. Like the,
but see, I believe that journalism can be done by people who are not journalists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. But that there are historical fights about who is a journalist
and
not.
Yes, of course.
But then that's the thing. I don't know what journalism.
The definition of the word journalism is it's information about something that's relevant to more than two people.
That just suggests to me that having people who are specifically journalists is an abstraction that worked in a particular type of media culture that isn't necessarily generalizable.
It seems like there's a difference between journalists and journalism, because journalism is something that you're receiving as, like, something might be journalism to you if it's relevant, but
exactly.
It's not necessarily intended to be journalism.
But is it where journalism incorporates in itself checking of the facts, some kind of...
Good journalism does. Yes.
Yeah, but if you define journalism in terms of ethics, it's very problematic.
Not ethics, but at least the second person, or somebody other than the person who wrote a check in some kind of fact.
Well, that's reporting, like multiple angles, sort of what that does. I mean, it's really tricky because journalists traditionally are like writing secondary sources by compiling primary sources. But if you're going on Twitter and seeing what people are like messaging, then those are all primary sources. You can't really, how are they going to back those up? Like, I was there.
Right.
Like,
yeah, but then anything that ever reporting, if you use the word reporting, then you're implying that there was something that was observed and in theory favorable, you know, in theory with some level of veracity or, you know.
That there's a certain style adopted. I mean, I think
about
it.
Right, but not all of journalism, I mean, count only reporting as journalism? Not really.
But when you apply your definition, anything that ever written is journalism.
No, not really. I have to look up my definition because I don't actually, it isn't my definition, it's Michael Schutz.
Yeah, I think, yeah, but, he's my advisor, and
I think we should probably talk about this more after I'm going to do this, which is like officially close the meeting, and thank to the two presenters.
Thank you.